You're listening live to Right Side Radio with Phil Williams. It's hard to go wrong when you're on the right side. Right Side Radio, solid, conservative, and just plain right.
Alabama's syndicated news talk leader, Right Side Radio. Phil Williams here live in the Right Side studios. Man, we got the local, the state, the national. We cover down on all of the issues. And like the dude just said, we are solid conservative and just plain right. Well, today is a day that I've been looking forward to for quite some time. I had the opportunity a few years ago to meet retired Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin. You're about to meet him here yourself. But let me just go ahead and just say right up front that General Boykin has been on my list of people that I admire from a distance for quite a while, having read his book when it first came out in 2008. Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin, he's a retired U.S. Army three-star general, served under the George W. Bush administration as the Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence, currently serves as the Executive Vice President of the Family Research Council. He's an author. He teaches at Hampton-Sydney College. And all that, if that's not enough, he's also been basically one of the legacy members of Army Special Operations to include being a plank holder in what we now refer to as Delta Force. I'm going to tell you right now, he has served in almost everything that they've made a movie about in the last 30 years. Operation Eagle Claw, the attempt to rescue the Iran hostages, the invasion of Grenada, where he earned a Purple Heart, the hunt for Pablo Escobar in South America, the hunt for Manuel Noriega in Panama, the Battle of Mogadishu, we call Black Hawk Down. He was in all of them. Being a member of 1st Special Forces Operations Detachment Delta, he's been in a lot of things, too, that we can't even talk about. But I am pleased to recognize that he is here on the air with us. And General Boykin, thanks for joining Right Side Radio.
Well, Phil, you know it's a real privilege for me to be on your program.
Well, sir, thank you for your time. And I'll be honest with you, I did read your book. I've got it right here with me. In 2008, I think, is when it came out. It's a little dog-eared, but I want to talk through parts of it today. But let me just ask you, you spent, what, 36 years in service, something like that?
Yeah, actually 36 and a half years.
Well, you had an amazing career, and I'm not kidding when I say that there have been movies and books written about missions that you took part in personally. Am I correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Well, all that to say, sir, you're also a man of great faith, and I think one of the things that I have most admired, and many people I know have said the same, is that throughout your entire career, even when it was uncomfortable to do so, maybe, you were pretty much very open about your faith, about the fact that you know that service to our country is not something that is not allowed when you're also somebody who loves the Lord, and I've appreciated that.
Yeah, Phil, it's I must tell you that the Army that I came up through for 36 and a half years was a different Army than what we see today. And I never had any trouble living my faith. I never received any kind of admonitions or anything from my chain of command for living my faith. And that included praying before missions, assembling the whole group and praying before our mission. So, but today it's different. Today, I think that the idea of openly living your faith is something that a lot of people are getting dinged for, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of people today that are getting discouraged because as they try to live their faith, they find it more and more difficult.
Well, you know, speaking of which, I mean, having kind of reviewed your book again to get ready for today, I think it was page 60. You actually, before you went into special operations, you were an infantry officer, and you had a young specialist, I think, came to you one day and said, "How do you justify being a Christian and also knowing that you're in a profession that may cause you to have to kill people?" And you actually went to your pastor to review that with him. You want to talk about that for a second?
Well, yeah, sure. He reminded me that the Bible doesn't say thou shalt not kill. It says thou shalt not murder. It's a totally different concept. And furthermore, he made the point that if you believe that the Bible does say thou shalt not kill, then you must believe that God changed his mind by the time he reached the Jordan River, because when they got to the Jordan River, he said, kill them all. But I think one of the most important things was, he said, do you believe that the 56 men that signed that Declaration of Independence that became what we call the Founding Fathers, do you believe that they were inspired by the Holy Spirit? Yes, I do. I absolutely do. And he said, then you believe that the creation of this nation was inspired by the Holy Spirit? Yes, I do. And he said, then you think that Christians get a pass on defending it?
Wow.
On preserving it?
Wow.
On sacrificing for it? And the answer to that was, no, I don't believe Christians get a pass. And he said, well, you got your answer.
Wow, that's a pastor after my own heart right there. Well, let me ask you, though, your career has been something else. And I want to get back to the praying in front of missions or before missions here in just a minute. But one of those key prayers came as a result of the fact that you got a mysterious phone call one day from Army Personnel Command, and they wouldn't tell you what it was about. They just said, we want you to volunteer, basically, for a top secret unit that's being formed. And they didn't tell you much of anything else. And you wound up becoming one of the original members of Delta Force. Can you talk about, you know, stepping into something that no one knew what it was going to be and how that went?
Yeah, that was early January of 1978, and the Army personnel system called me, and the major on the other end said, Captain Boykin, I'm going to ask you to volunteer for a new unit that's being formed at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. It's top secret. I can't tell you much about it. All I can tell you is I want you to come up here and go through a 30-day trial, and if you make it through that 30-day trial, we'll ask you to volunteer for an assignment in this very secretive unit. And all I can tell you is you need to be in the best physical condition that you've ever been in before you get here. That was it. And he said, then he said, and I need your answer in an hour. Well, I did what every Christian man does when he's confronted like that. You know, I called my mother. And I write about that in the book. I called my mother. I said, Mom, this is a praying woman. Now, you need to understand, this is a praying woman. This is an intercessor. And I said, I don't know what this is, and I don't know if this is where God wants me, but I'm going to ask you to pray with me and pray for me that if this is where God wants me, that I'll have what it takes to get through this. And she prayed with me right then, and she said, I'll be praying with you while you're there. And she did. She prayed for me every day.
Well, and I would anticipate that next 30 days was one of the best, worst experiences of your life. Am I right?
It was. It was indeed. It was one of the best, worst experiences I've ever had. But I tell you what, I came out of that emboldened in many ways. My faith was stronger because I had relied so heavily upon Jesus Christ, to guide me through those mountains in the middle of the winter as we went mile after mile after mile. And, you know, the last day in there, we went 40 miles through those mountains with very heavy loads on our back. And each man was by himself. So I was finding my own way. And I did that 40 miles in 11 hours and 27 minutes. And I tell people that wasn't me. That was the power of the Holy Spirit. It was the power that God gave me to be able to get through that and to do so in a very good way. So I was the first one through.
Wow.
We started with 118 people and we finished with 19 when it was all said and done.
Well, and one of the legends of Special Operations, Colonel Charlie Beckwith, was the guy who headed things up at the time. And anybody who's familiar with Charlie Beckwith knows why I say legends, but if you don't know him, go look him up, because you could make a movie about him just by itself. But sir, you went on to become a member of Delta Force. You participated in a number of operations, some of which we probably still don't know about. But you were there for Operation Eagle Claw at Desert One, the attempt to rescue the Iran hostages. But one of the things that really struck me was, it wasn't always comfortable to be the guy who loved the Lord in the ranks of a bunch of rowdy guys who were in Delta, but you were then asked, though, by Charlie Beckwith, I think it was, to actually pray for the mission in front of everybody before y'all got on the planes and went to Desert One. Am I right?
Yeah, that's right. Oh, Charlie was a unique character, as you've already said. He was an old Georgia football player, great big guy, and he was a legend, though. He had been shot in the belly in Vietnam with a 50 caliber, and he survived it. And the only thing he promised us when we were finally through the selection course was he promised us a medal and a body bag.
Wow.
Of course, I was in for the medal. The body bag didn't sell too good, but that was Charlie. But he, you know, after he accepted me into the Delta Force, he treated me with contempt for about 2 years. And I finally figured out what it was, and that was because I said I was a Christian, but he wasn't against Christians. He just wanted to see if I was really a Christian, because he had seen Christians that talk the talk, but they didn't walk the walk. He needed to know what he was dealing with. He needed to know whether I was really a Christian, and I would stand my ground. I would stand on my faith. I would not compromise, like he's seen so many Christians do. And then the night of the 24th of April, 1980, before we went into Iran to rescue 52 Americans that were being held by the followers of the Ayatollah Khomeini at the U.S. Embassy in Tehran, Charlie came up to me and he said, "Jerry, tomorrow morning, before we launch this operation, will you get these men together and will you ask God's blessings upon us to protect us and bring us home?" And wow. That's when I realized I had passed his test. I had met his standard for being a Christian.
Wow.
And from that point on, that became a standard. I prayed before every operation, and I mean, led the entire assembly in prayer before every operation. But it was a lesson for me too, and that is, don't compromise on your faith.
Wow.
Don't compromise. You can be forgiven for it. But what you don't realize is the number of people that that lose confidence in you and in your faith, the number of people that are discouraged by seeing you compromise. So I stood my ground and continued to live my faith. And ultimately it came down to being asked to pray before that mission, but also before subsequent missions after that.
Well, General, that's a point where I've got to take us to a break. What a great segue. So if you'll hang tight, we're going to come right back. I want to talk about the fact, though, that you've also been through some personal experiences that became very physical with injuries sustained in combat. We'll talk about that with General Jerry Boykin when we come right back. Phil Williams, Right Side Radio, solid conservative, just plain right. Y'all hang tight. We'll be right back. And we are back. Phil Williams, Right Side Radio, solid conservative and just plain right, covering all of North Alabama. We are back in an interview with retired Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin, founding member of Delta Force. Actually went on after a very storied career to be the commander of all special forces, and retired with 3 stars. General, right before the break, you talked to us about your faith, about being asked to pray after kind of passing Colonel Charlie Beckwith's test. You're a member of Delta, Operation Eagle Claw. But then subsequent missions, there was the invasion of Grenada, which was, you know, one of the first true attempts at integrated special operations and joint operations. And a lot of things came out of Grenada that changed the way we do business, so to speak. But in the course of that operation, as you were going in the helo full of other operators, you actually took a 50 caliber round that destroyed your left arm. But then talk to us about what happened and when the doctors told you may or may not ever get your arm back.
Yeah, I was in coming into a target in a Black Hawk helicopter, sitting in the door, and got hit, and I was hit up in the side of my chest, took a little chunk out of my rib cage there, but didn't go into my lungs. But then round came right up through my armpit, and it paralyzed my arm. I thought they had actually shot my arm off, and I reached over to stop the bleeding, but then I realized I still had the arm. It just wasn't functional. I couldn't feel it or anything. They took me out to a carrier, operated on me, brought me back to Fort Bragg, operated on me a second time at Fort Bragg. And when I woke up in the recovery room, there was a medical team there, and this is what they said. They said, "Sir, we need to," they said, "you got a serious injury. We need to take your arm off." I said, "What's plan B?" Yeah. They didn't have a plan B, and they said, "You don't understand. The nerve in your arm is damaged so bad it's not going to regenerate, and you are full of shrapnel and bullet fragments up in your left side." And they said, "If we don't take that arm off, the infection could kill you." And I said to them, and this is exactly what I said. I said, "I believe God has assured me that if I'll trust him, he'll heal me. So you just do the very best you can and let God do the rest." And of course they gave me the old, "Well, you've got a good attitude," but you could see they didn't think that there was any chance that I was ever going to use that arm again, and I was ever going to have a functional arm there. And but God gets the last vote, and so there it is. You know, it's a good arm, a good hand, and God did, in fact, bring me through what they said couldn't happen, and God still works miracles.
Well, and that's so true. I mean, it was when you read the book too, and I reviewed that part again because I knew I wanted to bring it up in the interview here today. I was struck by the fact that it wasn't just a matter of regenerating the nerves; the bones were shattered, and they literally were not sure the bones would ever regraft themselves, and they put you into all kinds of contraptions trying to get that thing to seat itself. And then at one point though, you began to move two fingers and then three fingers. And I love the fact you said you had a doctor who didn't share your faith, who just almost, you know, sort of gave you a condescending look every time you said something. And then one day he said, "Well, it looks like things are touching again."
Yeah. I'd go in every Friday. This doctor was from Duke University, and I'd go in every Friday, and he'd say, "No," he'd x-ray me, and he'd say, "No, the bones aren't touching. No, the bones aren't touching. No, the bones aren't touching." And one day, I walked in there, and I just knew. I said, "Doc, you're going to like it today." And he said, "Why?" I said, "Because the bones are touching." And he just kind of looked at me like, "And how do you know that?" And he looked at that x-ray, and he looked back at me, and he looked back at the x-ray, and then he turned around and he said, "The bones are touching. It's going to heal." And I said, "All right, take this cast off so I can go play golf." And by that time, the guy thought I was so stupid. He said, I can take the cast off, but I don't want you out there trying to play golf." I said, "Okay." I won't.
Well, General, and one of the things, and we're going to do a little more here in the interview talking about modern culture and where we are in the U.S. military, but I just want to take that moment there and say the entire book is full of stories like that. I mean, between hunting for Pablo Escobar and dealing with the Battle of Mogadishu and the invasion of Panama and rescuing hostages in Sudan, I mean, you've led an amazing career. The book's called Never Surrender by Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin. And you can find it on Amazon, and they're all over the place. I've had mine since 2008. But, folks, it's out there, and it's worth a read. We're going to come right back, though. General Boykin is a constant contributor to national news sources on modern culture, military policy, and foreign policy, and we'll get a few perspectives from him here right after this break. Phil Williams, Right Side Radio. Y'all stay tuned. We'll be right back. And we are back. Phil Williams, Right Side Radio, covering all of North Alabama. I mean, we are down south of Birmingham, up north of Huntsville, Tuscaloosa, over to Gadsden. We got parts of Georgia, Tennessee, and Mississippi thrown in just for good measure. Boomer, did you play "Carry On My Wayward Son" for the general? Is that did you do that on purpose?
Just you know, I just wanted to throw something in there.
Okay. Anyway, Boomer takes a little license once in a while. Hey, sir. Thank you for giving us just a few thoughts on your own career and things about your book, but in your personal story. But let me ask you this: current culture. I mean, There's a lot of things that are being said right now about the current state of our military. And I've still got family members on active duty myself. And I'll be honest, I look at it and I get distressed when I see woke culture constantly being put into our military academies. I just saw the other day the Air Force Special Operations has just built a new $66 million facility for their aquatic training, and they're making it, you know, mixed gender bathrooms and locker rooms. It just goes on and on. But then I also see other things like right now they're saying that upwards of 77% of kids in the recruiting pool are not eligible for military service. What are your thoughts on the state of recruiting, military readiness, and just give us your perspectives?
Well, first of all, that 77% is probably one of the most daunting statistics that we have, and that is largely because people that are of the age that they can join the military or be drafted into the military, they are overweight, they have felony charges against them, they have a history of drug abuse, all kinds of things. They have diabetes, and a lot of it is just because of they're so out of shape, and our culture has now changed so much that drug abuse is far greater problem than it was in my day when I came along. That said, I think we need to recognize that if you want to change America, if you want to change the culture in America, you have to change the military, and that's why the military has been targeted. You see, the military is the bastion of traditional values. And those values, as you know, Phil, are encapsulated in the Uniform Code of Military Justice. That's the legal system within the military. And where things like adultery are a crime. Adultery is a crime. Is that a crime anywhere else in America? No. No. But it is in the United States military, and there's a reason for that. And other things that we just kind of look over in society are still against the code that we call the Uniform Code of Military Justice. So if you're going to change America, you got to start with the military. And that's what's happening. There is an all-out effort to change this nation by changing our military, by forcing our military into becoming a woke culture, which does nothing but create racism in our military. It divides the people in our military, and then we have set ourselves up now for a military that is woke, that is well informed on the latest LGBT issues, but they're not ready to fight. Wow. And young men and women all over America are looking at that and saying, I'm not going into the military and let them bully me the way they're bullying their soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, and Coast Guardsmen to take the jab. And now it's so bad, recruiting is so bad, that the Army is sending out emails to retired generals like me asking us to please help them to recruit.
Wow.
I can tell them why they can't recruit, and that is because you're not training these young men and women for war, and they know that, and they don't want to be part of what they see happening.
Well, and I did a monologue. I do a monologue when I open my show every day, and I did a monologue, I think it was last week, and I pointed out that Ernest Shackleton, when he did his expedition to the Antarctic, he sent out an ad, and he basically just told people, if you want to join, you can expect long hours of misery, and coming home is not guaranteed, and pay will be low. And he had more people sign up than he could take. And the reality is, if you will challenge them, if you will give them the glory of high expectations, so to speak, kids will sign up in droves. But if you tell them they're going to sign up so they can become more sensitive, or so they can change their viewpoint, or they can be contrary to what their family said was okay, you're going to continue to see those recruiting efforts suffer. 40-year low right now.
That's exactly right. And, you know, I have said this a number of times on different TV and radio outlets, but just look at the Ukraine, for example, the war between Russia and Ukraine. Well, Ukraine's winning,
yeah,
but they're not supposed to, because they're grossly outnumbered by a far superior force. But the thing that equalizes on the battlefield is two things. One is unity, and the other is purpose. The Ukrainians are unified. Those soldiers, they're fighting for their future. They're fighting for their homeland. They have a unified spirit because of what they're fighting for. And the second thing is purpose. And again, they have a purpose. They have to defeat the Russians there if they're ever going to have a nation again. So if you take those two things away, which is essentially what we've done now in our military, you take those things away, then you don't have a capable, ready military that's ready to step up and meet the challenges of this century, the challenges that we are seeing right now with China, Russia, Iran, North Korea, just go down the line.
Well, and General, in your career, I mean, I served 30 years. My father was a career officer. My grandfather was a career officer. Grandfather retired as a brigadier. He was a glider rider in World War II. But in any of my generational, you know, views of the military, I never saw systemic racism. I never saw overt discrimination. In fact, my dad used to be so proud of the fact, in his words, the military was the very first true melting pot of American society. In your career, did you ever see what they often refer to now as systemic racism and extremism in the ranks?
I did not. I never saw it. I never saw white supremacy. I never saw a bunch of the things that that we're hearing them talk about today. Like Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, he's talking about white rage and white supremacy. I never saw that. I mean, in 36 plus years, I never saw that. A lot of this stuff is contrived to suit the agenda of the people who are pushing this. And they're creating a problem. They are a solution looking for a problem.
Well, that's a great phrase, and I agree. Boomer, how much time we got on this segment? Are we doing on time? All right. A couple minutes? Yeah. General, before we head to the next break, let me ask you this. You recently signed on to be one of the not plaintiffs, but you were basically a stakeholder with an interest in the Navy SEALs lawsuit regarding vaccine mandates. Now, you and I have both had more shots than we can count. Military service requires you to give away some of your personal freedoms in order to do the things that are necessary for the good order and discipline, and that might include shots. But at the same time, this one feels different, and I'd like your perspective here in about a minute or so on why the vaccine mandate we're under now is different.
Yeah. Have you ever heard of any of these other shots that we took while we were in the military that have caused the kinds of problems that are documented with regards to this vaccination? I haven't, and I was listening to Dr. Ben Carson about 4 weeks ago at an event, and Dr. Carson said this vaccine has more problems and more negative reactions than all the other vaccines in America today. So young soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, Coast Guardsmen, they are watching this and they see this. They see that there's problems with this, and they don't want it, and a lot of them don't want it on religious grounds because some of it has fetal stem cells in it and other things that they object to injecting this into their body. So they have every right, as far as I am concerned, to object to it and not be forced to take it. But we're kicking them out of the military today at the same time that we can't recruit enough people.
Well, and right now we're looking at too the National Guard, which has a huge component of special operations that you used to command. We have two special forces groups in the Guard. They're looking at somewhere upwards of 40,000 to 60,000 that may be lost overall. And you can't tell me it's not going to affect readiness.
Absolutely, it's going to affect readiness. And look, keep in mind that the National Guard is the front line at home.
Right.
In fact, its mission is to win the nation's wars, but it can also be used in things like these hurricanes. And you look at the National Guard down in Florida right now, and you'll see that they're doing above and beyond what should be expected.
Well, General, I'll tell you what, we're going to go ahead and take the last break. When we come back, I'd just like to touch base with you. I understand you've got a new book out and in conjunction with the Family Research Council, and we'll give you a chance to tell us about that. And all right, Boomer, take us to the break, brother. Phil Williams, Right Side Radio, here with Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin. We'll be right back. We are back, Phil Williams, Right Side Radio, covering all of North Alabama, saving the world one soundbite at a time, I like to say. All right, folks, we are here with Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin, a legend in special operations. His book is Never Surrender. In a minute, we're going to talk with him about another book that he and members of the Family Research Council have recently come out with. But before I do that, General, I served in Afghanistan. A lot of my listeners are veterans. We have quite a military community here in North Alabama. And some are still green suiters, some are retired, but then a bunch of them served in Afghanistan or have family members who did. The Afghanistan pullout in August of 21, the news broke while I was actually on the air, and it became a multi-week event on my show. We air 3 hours a day across North Alabama. I even had a Gold Star mother call and cry on the air asking, did her son die for nothing? It was just a series of constant conversations, almost like we did therapy online or on air. But I'm a firm believer the war had to end at some point. I think we could have left a forward presence. You know, we're still in Germany and Japan was my thought. I don't know about yours, but the reality is the way the pullout went is, I think, what has distressed so many people. And I'd like your thoughts on that. Maybe you disagree with me on some parts of it, but I'd like to hear your thoughts.
I think it will go down in history as the greatest foreign policy failure in American history. It didn't have to go that way. And furthermore, you kind of said it, all the military commanders were asking for was a presence of 2,500 people to maintain a capability to collect intelligence and to do counterterror operations. I don't believe that that was a burden on our military or on our budget or anything else. So I think that the way we pulled out of there in large measure was the deciding factor when Vladimir Putin had to determine whether he was going to cross that border and come into Ukraine. I think if we had pulled out of there in a way that we preserved our honor and met our commitments to our friends and our citizens and all that, I don't believe Putin would have gone into the Ukraine. So I think that it's reverberating. I think that it has emboldened China, for example, and Iran and all of the rest of the of our enemies, I think, have been emboldened by watching that debacle when we pulled out of Afghanistan.
Yeah, and I don't know. I don't know there's ever been a true White House acknowledgement of the 13 service members that died at the gate of the airport when the terrorist bombing took place during the pullout. But what was also amazing to see was how many Americans we just left behind. I mean, I've never seen that before. I mean, you as a member of Delta used to go in and rescue even sometimes just a handful of people, like the mission in Sudan. And here we left behind what came out to be well over 1,000 American citizens, and not to mention the allies and green card holders who were still there.
No, that is absolutely right. You know what a lot of people don't realize is in Mogadishu during the Black Hawk Down events, we fought 18 hours for two dead bodies.
Yeah.
No one was willing to leave those men behind.
Wow.
Even though they were dead. They were trapped inside the crash. We fought 18 hours to make sure that we got their bodies out because the Ranger Creed says, never shall I leave a fallen comrade to fall into the hands of the enemy, and we lived by that. And when we stopped living by that code, you see the kind of debacle that we had in Afghanistan when we pulled out of there, where a know-nothing president, and I'm being very critical now, and I realize that, but a know-nothing president that doesn't know anything about military operations made decisions that wound up causing us to not only lose our honor as a nation, but to leave people behind to be dealt with by the Taliban. That is embarrassing and inexcusable as far as I'm concerned, and I'm sorry I got wound up a little bit on that one.
No, sir. I don't know that I even need to try and add to that, but thank you for your comments on that. Let me just switch gears, sir. What do we have, Boomer, about 3 minutes left? Yeah, we got about 3 minutes left. I want to make sure that I cover down on the fact that we can both take a deep breath now, but you just came out with a new book. My understanding is it's called Strong and Courageous, A Call to Biblical Manhood. It's a sequel to another book you've got, and I love the title. I'm in a men's small group right now that's covering down on similar topics. I'd like to hear your thoughts on your new book.
Yeah, about 2 years ago, I released a book called Man to Man, and it was really identified five things that a man is supposed to be, biblically, that a man is supposed to be. And then this book, Strong and Courageous, uses Joshua as the model for the things that men are supposed to be. Joshua, even though if you look in the Bible, you can't find any reference to him being married or having a family, but he did stand up there in the desert right before he died, and he said, "As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord." He was giving direction. He was providing them with direction. So it is about Joshua and his life, and it shows how he represents everything that a man is supposed to be, that we wrote about, that I wrote about in Man to Man, the book that is the prequel to that.
Wow, sir. Where can that book be found? Is it out? Is it already published? Is it put out now?
It's already out. You can get it on Amazon, or you can go to the Family Research Council website, frc.org, and find the store there. And we've got it. We've got them available there too. But get the book. It's also designed like Man to Man was for men's small groups and men's Bible studies. So we set it up that way just so men's groups could use it for that.
Well, sir, this has been an honor. It's an honor to know you, to make your acquaintance, but to have you on the show today is also a high honor. I certainly appreciate your time, and we look forward to hearing more from you in the days to come. Folks, we've been with Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin. He is a retired special operator, one of the plank holders, one of the first members of Delta Force, who served in almost every single mission they've made movies about, and he's also a man of faith who's not afraid to say so. Sir, thanks for your time. You have a great day.
It's great being with you, Phil. God bless you, brother.
All right, take care. All right, Boomer, take us out to the break. We'll do that. Folks, Right Side Radio, solid conservative, just plain right. We'll be right back.